Well, gentlemen, there's our answer.
To what?
How Andromeda functions without amino acids.
Crystalline structure.
Yes.
It's dividing. In a vacuum?
Bombarded by electrons? It shouldn't even be alive.
That's what I wanted to tell you. The growth program shows Andromeda can live on anything.
Andromeda's perfect for existence in outer space. Consumes everything. Wastes nothing.
I'm Andrea Johnson, and you're listening to Retro Rockets. Join us as we explore the deep heritage of science fiction and fantasy, yesterday, today, and tomorrow. Welcome aboard. Rachel, welcome to Retro Rockets. Do you want to introduce yourself and tell our listeners a little bit about yourself?
Sure, thank you for asking me. I started the website sfintranslation.com to track and promote speculative fiction from around the world. I just published a book about it called Out of This World, SF in Translation from the Cold War to the New Millennium. And that was my attempt to kind of expand on kind of analysis and interpretation of what we've been getting in terms of SFT for the past 60, 70 years. I'm also on Twitter, tweeting mostly about SF in Translation at R. Cordas, so without the CO. And I used to be an editor. Now I'm just freelance, writing about SFT and sometimes about Wisconsin history, which is an interesting mix. And I have three young kids that make my brain go in many directions. But so this is me. Also, I'm originally from the East Coast, but now I live in Wisconsin, so I love living here. And yeah, that's what I've been doing lately.
I'm in Michigan, so if you get bad weather, let me know, because whatever you get, I'm going to get 2 hours later as it comes across the lake.
Yes, I was not expecting a tornado watch today, so.
Well, if you suddenly go flying off, we'll know.
Yeah.
And I'll watch the weather to see if there's going to be tornadoes here in a few hours.
Now I got my phone here. This is messed up. Yesterday was so pretty, and today it's just, I don't know.
Thank you, Midwest weather. Mm-hmm. How did you get into science fiction? I assume you've been reading speculative fiction for possibly most of your adult life. How did your love get started?
So I've always loved reading. Of course, and I wasn't into science fiction until my brothers were always watching Star Trek, The Next Generation, and Star Wars, and both were always on, but Star Wars just never really stuck with me, but Star Trek really kind of got a hold of me, and I remember one day I just wandered in, and they were watching I think it was the Time's Arrow, double episode. And there was Mark Twain and Jack London. And I was like, mind blown, it was like literature meets science fiction. And I started watching it when they were watching it. And then I got totally hooked. So I started reading more science fiction. And then I kind of veered away from it, and for I guess most of like middle high school and college and grad school I was reading American literature and literature from other countries, but never in their language. Like, I was always reading like Dostoevsky and Flaubert and translation and everything, and I loved French, and I really considered becoming like a French literature major. But I loved the literature, and I loved French, but I was told that if I wanted to become a French professor, I would wind up teaching French language and not French literature. And I was like, well, I don't want to do that. I want to be a literature professor. And so they said, well, you're going to have to do something in English. And I was like, fine. But then I started kind of going back to science fiction because I was like, I remember I loved that so much. And I started reading more of the classics. And then just a lot of things were happening. And I thought, you know, I have these babies. I'm not working outside the house. I need to keep my brain going. And I thought, you know, I know that there are these websites that publish reviews of books. And I thought, maybe if I start reading some more recent science fiction and then writing reviews, I can get those published and I can keep my brain going while I wait for the kids to be old enough so I could send them to nursery school. And then I can, and then I can go back to work. So that was my plan. And that's how I got writing for John DiNardo at SF Signal. And that was really fun. And then he sent me the Three Body Problem. And he said, would you like to review this? And I was like, what is this thing? This is amazing. And then he sent me Jessica Dukaj, his book, The Old Axolotl, or however it's pronounced. So Polish SFT. And I thought, wait a minute. There's Chinese, there's Polish. And I was like, I like making lists. I'm going to make a list of some of the recent stuff that's come out from in other languages because I love things in translation and I love, you know, science fiction. And I was like, there can't be that much. And, you know, 6 years later, I've got like a list of like a couple thousand stories, hundreds of novels and books and other things. And it was really just kind of wondering what is there really a lot of science fiction and fantasy and horror written in other languages. And I literally had no idea. I mean, it's just so much. And so that's kind of how I got into it. And then once you start writing for one place, other places say, hey, can you write something for us? And then it just kind of snowballs. And then that's how it's become, you know, a whole thing for me. So,
and your website has become such a resource. It's, I read something that I loved that came out of China. What other science fiction is coming out of China? I'm going to go to Rachel's website because that's an excellent resource.
Well, that's exactly what I want people to use it for. I want it to be like for people who are like, you know, I just want to read something different. My family came over here from Poland, you know, 100 years ago. Like, I wonder what Polish SF is out there, you know, and like, I've heard of Stanislaw Lem, but I never read anything about it. What's available in English? There's a ton that is and a ton that isn't. So, you know, I want this to be a place for people to see kind of what's out there. And the other thing that bothers me, my pet peeve, is when there's a like a new thing, you know, whether it's like Scandinavian, you know, murder mysteries or like Japanese horror or like some sort of thing where it's like, you know, or Three Body Problem too. Like when something becomes like a phenomenon and everybody just like runs to that thing. And like, I'm standing here going, but there's other stuff going on here. Like, I want people to know that it's not just like people were thinking that only Chinese science fiction was being translated for like a few years. And I was like, no, look at all this other stuff. That's one part of like this huge, you know, constellation of, you know, world SF that's being written and translated and published and everything. So we shouldn't just focus on one thing. We should make sure that we're aware that there's a lot more going on. And that's what I want my site to show. It's not just like, this is the big thing, but this is, you know, these are all the things that are happening. So while everybody's being distracted with, you know, thing X, you won't miss this other stuff that's coming up that's also exciting. So I want people to see the broad range that's happening.
I like that you're offering, you know, a bigger picture and more variety, because it's so easy to fall into that, oh, I'm only going to read, you know, this author coming out of China, or, you know, all Polish science fiction must be like this.
Yeah, right.
And it's super not. So it's, and I like to read, you know, just a wide variety. I don't want to get stuck into one little silo. So yeah. Thank you 100 times for your website. Yeah. So I can find these things, and, you know, it's, I think I'm already driving my local librarians crazy, because like every public library has a little spot where you can request that they purchase a book.
Mm-hmm.
Boy, am I asking for obscure things. Because of your website.
Yeah, you can yell at you. Just give them my name. They can yell at me.
Okay.
Yeah.
I will do that. I will do that. Actually, if I give them your name, they're probably just going to invite you to give a seminar on translated fiction, which would also be great.
That would be great. But even my library has it. I actually, like, filled out a thing for my own public library system. And I was like, if y'all ever want me to, like, talk to people about this stuff, and you could set up a table and, like, have all these bugs and stuff. And like, yeah, I haven't heard back.
Hey, keep, it's like getting short fiction published. Just keep trying.
Keep trying.
Keep submitting.
Mm-hmm.
Why do you think it is, why is it important for Americans and people from English-speaking countries to read science fiction that's been translated, science fiction from other parts of the world?
I mean, I guess the main drive is that kind of human nature thing where it's like, I love it, you gotta love it too, you know. And I know that that's not, you know, that's not always a reality, but it's when you love something so much, you tend to want to try to share it with other people to get them to so you can have other people to talk to about it, you know. So that's kind of the selfish reason. The other reason is that, from what I've noticed, just kind of in general, American media generally seems to be more insular now than it ever used to be. Like, everything is so much about, well, what's going on in the U.S., what's going on in the U.S., and you're like, what's going on in other countries? And, like, you hear, like, random news stories about what's going on in, like, Zimbabwe, and you're like, oh, what, you know, where did that come from? How did that happen? Or like French elections, you know, out of nowhere, they're like, there's an election in France. And everybody's like, wait, what? And like, we don't know what's going on. And I feel like our publishing, you know, is the same way, where there was this belief that translations, people don't want translations because translations are like, almost like a like secondhand kind of thing, which they are absolutely not. But I think some people think that like translations are not going to be, you know, as good as the original, or that the original is somehow better than a translation. Or I guess it's just a matter of like, you know, kind of when you're in school and you get books and it's like, if you're reading like a book from another country, there's really not maybe a lot of talk about what went into the fact that like Crime and Punishment was written in Russian, but you're reading it in English. It's just kind of like, here's Crime and Punishment. It's a classic. Read it.
But there's no context when you're just like, hey, here's this, read it. And like, it doesn't come with any context.
Right. Why would this Russian guy write this book about a guy like killing a woman and like, it just, you know, yeah, there's no context. And I love context and history. And like, I want to know why things are happening. And I think it's just this general, like, in the U.S., we don't necessarily need to know other languages. We don't need to look very far beyond our borders. I think it's like, it is a geographical thing, but it's also just an education thing. It's just like, why should we care? And ultimately, in the more general sense, I think we should care because, you know, we do live on this planet with other people. And I think that it's better generally to know what everybody else is doing, to understand everybody, like what everybody else is kind of talking about. And weirdly enough, like, I mean, science fiction often is
It's a reaction to what's happening in the world. It's a safe way to talk about, it could be good things that are happening, scary things that are happening, worrisome things that are happening, and it gives some context of what was happening in that place when the author was writing that book.
Yeah, and it gives us a richer understanding of just our planet and other people. And I think that people having a perspective, hearing a perspective that is like radically different from your own. I mean, to me, that's like giving my brain like candy or something, you know. I love that. I love hearing about other things, because, you know, maybe 9 out of 10 times I'll be like, what, you know, but like that other time I'll say, that's so cool.
And even if you're like, what? Sometimes that can be followed by, ooh, I want to learn more.
Exactly. Rarely, I think, because we've also been, I feel like nowadays, you know, the tendency is not like, that's weird, that means it's bad. It's like, oh, that's weird, and that's interesting, and I want to learn more about it. And you know what? I may not think that that may not be a thing I want to do, or a thing that I'm, you know, that's something that I can incorporate in my life, but it's a thing that occurs, and it's what people do. And, you know, it's a tradition that you have in a country, or it's like, you know, family traditions or religious traditions. And, you know, I love knowing kind of like where that came from, and then how that, you know, what the equivalent is in like America, you know, like when I can find like a tradition that someone does with their family, with like a certain kind of food, you know, something as like small as like, I married an Italian man, and, you know, I never realized that biscotti in, you know, Italian biscotti are very similar to this other thing that my grandma used to bake from Eastern Europe. It's like, it's a very, you know, it's a similar kind of thing that you wouldn't otherwise know unless you say, oh, well, that's kind of like, you know, that's like what my family does. And so I guess I just think that it's, you know, I'm not going to say that reading more international literature will bring about world peace, but I'm kind of saying that because I think that it's easier to think, you know, like what's wrong with those people when you don't know anything about them. But when you know more about other people and other traditions, I think it leads to just kind of, you know, less kind of, you know, intolerance and stuff. And again, I don't want to sound like, oh, we're all going to like hold hands and love each other.
But might.
I mean, it could happen.
And it's, you know, as we read more wildly and from cultures we're not as familiar with, we find, you know, like your experience, you had food in common. Mm-hmm. You know, there was a similarity there. You know, if I'm reading science fiction from India, it's, hey, these folks are worried about climate change. I'm worried about climate change. Look what we have in common. And once you find one thing in common, you get itchy to find more things in common. Mm-hmm. And I'm not saying it's going to bring about world peace, but yes, we're saying that. But I think it helps people realize that we have so much more in common than we think.
Yeah, exactly. And it pushes you out of your comfort zone.
Yes.
You know, I'm not a world traveler. I mean, I wish I was, but I'm at this point in my life, it's not feasible for me to travel the world, but I always wanted to. And the next best way to do it is to read.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. I mean, I could say the same thing about film, you know, but I'm more of a reader than a film watcher. But, you know, reading for me has always been, you can travel in space and time. You know, why not? I mean, I would read all day long if I could, but then I think my kids would kill me. So, yeah.
They would trash the kitchen.
They would. They would trash the entire house.
Aw. So we've been talking about the the joy of reading translated science fiction. So blow up my to-be-read list. Give me some favorites of yours. Give me some titles that you were intrigued by. Let's blow up everybody's to-be-read list.
Oh, my goodness. Okay, well, I'll start, from the most recent and move backward. So right now I'm reading, I've been working on an essay about Hebrew SF in translation for an anthology of essays about Israeli SF. And so I've been reading a lot of it. So right now I'm in the middle of a trilogy by Shimon Adaf, and it's called The Lost Detective Trilogy. And it's it starts off, the first two books are it's detective genre, but Shimon Adaf's work is very it's hard to explain. It's like there's something kind of fantastic and unexpected kind of underneath everything. And you feel like it erupts kind of here and there, because he's a poet and a musician, and he writes very poetically. And some of these mysteries are in the books are kind of like there's more to it. It wasn't just that somebody disappeared, but somebody got on a bus and then they arrived at their destination, and it was supposed to be an hour, and it took them 3 days, and they don't remember how that happened. And so you're like, well, what's that about? And there's a lot of references to science fiction. There's a lot of references to Borges, Poe, Lovecraft. He's such a unique author. And his previous book in English, Sunburnt Faces, was about a woman who hears God, or a girl who hears God talk to her through her television when she's little, and then she grows up to become a children's fantasy writer. And again, it's so hard to explain what the book is like, but it's what Revelation kind of does to her, and how it shapes her life, and how fantasy and reality are kind of two sides of the same coin. And so
Title's absolutely going on my list.
No, he's just the best. I love him so much. And so a couple of his stories are also available in English at various places. There's so much else. I know that a lot of people know about the Strugatsky brothers, Arkady and Boris Strugatsky. I've been reading a lot of them, but I think recently, I think a few years ago, Inhabited Planet, I think it's called. I think that's what it's called. I read that, and again, mind blown. I loved Roadside Picnic. But then I read The Inhabited Planet, and it was like this guy lands on a planet, and people's thought processes are being channeled by these like electromagnetic currents or something. And if you think wrong thoughts, you get a really bad headache or something. It's like,
that's so dystopian.
Dystopian, and I loved it. I love reading the Strugatskys. I'm very, I'm really excited about what's been coming out from Valancourt Books. They just published two anthologies of horror from around the world. So they've been publishing horror anthologies, but now it's from around the world. And they got everyone. I mean, they've got Greek and Italian Argentina and Japan and just all Korean everywhere. And a lot of these are the first time they've been in English. So that's Valancourt Books. We've also, there's just so much that I've that I've been reading. There's also Yoko Tawada is pretty interesting. she has now had one book in German that was translated into English, and then two translated from Japanese, because she's German-Japanese. So I read her book from German, but she's got a couple others, and she writes about, like, kind of dystopia. There was one about, like, a disease that kills off or a disease that attacks, like, younger people, and the older people are having to care for the younger generation, and it's kind of like the opposite of the usual, like, dystopia where all the adults are killed off and the young people have to, you know, move. Now it's like it's the opposite. And her recent book, which is called Scattered All Over the Earth, is about Japan has just vanished. And I don't know what happened to it. And anyone with Japanese ancestry is kind of like, they're all, you know, they're all in their diaspora, and they're trying to kind of find other people who remember what Japanese culture was like. You know, it's Japanese science fiction specifically has been amazing. I've read so many, like, books that have just blown my mind. It's very sophisticated, hard science fiction. So if you're really looking for that kind of thing, like aliens, you know, kind of space battles, AI, I would definitely, like, first place I'd say is Japanese science fiction. And sadly, the two publishers that were bringing that to us in English both closed down recently.
Oh, that's too bad. Who were those publishers, if you happen to know offhand?
It was Hikasoru, which was a division of Viz Media, and they just, you know, they do manga, and they were like, why are we, you know, I guess it wasn't selling well enough, the literary science fiction. And then Kurodahan, which was published out of, from a, I think an American living in Japan. And he had run it for a while, and now he's just retiring, and there's nobody taking it over. There's still a couple other places that publish it, but that's a real blow. I mean, that was some of the best stuff that I'd read, period. And so, you know, but they have a really big backlist. So I think if you're interested, Hikasoru and Kurodahan are really great. And yeah, I'm also just really excited about more books from, like, for instance, Norwegian. There's a woman named, I don't know how to pronounce it. I think it's Gunhild Oyaha, whatever. Gunhild. She has something that just came out this January called Present Tense Machine. There's a new collection by a Basque author.
Interesting.
This year. We've never had, I think this is the first Basque science fiction that we've had in English. You know, Nova Hellas was a Greek anthology of Greek science fiction in English. I think that came out last year or 2 years ago. So, yeah, that's the kind of thing I'm interested in, especially in languages that we don't normally see. So I love any language that, you know, with SF, like, I'm excited about anything. But, you know, the top three are always, like, Spanish, Japanese, you know, Chinese, and, you know, used to be a lot of French, not so much now. But when I see stuff from Bulgaria, you know, I get kind of like, oh, okay, this is something different, or Hebrew or Arabic or Korean or something like that. So I think that it's just getting more kind of just more variety. It's not less. And that, you know, that makes me really happy. And of course I have to plug my the Italian author that I translate, Clelia Faris. Creative Surgery is
her.
Oh,
that was such a good collection. I adored that collection.
I love her. She's so great. I love translating her stuff because she also is very hard to pin down. You wouldn't call it, some of her stuff you would call science fiction, but some of it you would call kind of like fantastical surrealism or something. And again, it's just beautiful. It's like, she talks about, like, she'll just create a scene and I'm just like, man, this is just beautiful. Like, I don't even have to know, like, what the, you know, it'll be like the first sentence and I'll be like, I don't know what this story is about, but I like it already. So, she's great. She is, technically she is from Sardinia, and Sardinia is a semi-autonomous state connected to Italy.
Is it a different dialect of Italian?
Yeah, Sardinian is different. It's close, but it's different than Italian. And she writes in standard Italian with Sardinian elements in it sometimes.
That so has to be a trip to translate.
Well, I had no idea Sardinian was its own thing until I started translating her, and then she was like, oh, she was, so you know the story, Gabala in the collection? Gabala, she's like, I'm sorry, she said, but this is kind of not going to be easy to, this is going to be almost impossible to translate because it's got the most Sardinian dialect in it. And I'm like, well, it's a good thing we have email then, isn't it? So I was like guessing at a lot of things, and then I was like, this sounds like this other word in Italian. Could it be this word? And then she'd be like, yes, that's similar, but it kind of means this. And we'd be back and forth and back and forth. And that's how we did it. But yeah, so she's also, you could say, well, Italian science fiction, there's also not a lot of that, but there's even less Sardinian science fiction. So she's great. She's got more, she's constantly writing. She's got a new novel coming out in Italian, and I would like to translate that.
I was going to say, when is your version coming out? Because I really like her style of surrealism. I love the way her characters talk about, well, we can do this, but should we do this? Yeah. I like the banter between her characters. Just like you said, I love how she sets a scene. And it's very surreal, and is what I love reading.
It's not the annoying surrealism where it's like,
no, you know, she's very approachable. It's very accessible. It's very approachable. Yeah. It's basically just, you know, people talking about whatever's happening. Mm-hmm. And it's weird and edgy, but very accessible.
Well, her story, The Substance of Ideas, is going to be in the Best of World SF2. Lady Tidar just, like, contacted me and was like, so, Substance of Ideas, like, I want to use it. And I was like, whoa, that's awesome. And he said, yeah, the fact that it's set on a kibbutz was pretty enticing. And I said, yeah, I honestly, she's now, I just translated, trying to find a publisher. I just translated a story of hers about two girls who go back in time to try to save Anne Frank. And so now she's written about Anne Frank, and she's written about a kibbutz, and she knows I'm Jewish, but like she wrote these, she's not Jewish, and I'm just like, I love these stories. And, you know, I don't know, I think she just likes those stories. It's been really great kind of like going back and forth, learning more about her. I just got a book out from the library about Sardinia, and I want to go there one day. And so I've been leaving it around the house for my husband to see. I mean, he's got family in Rome. Rome's not that far from Sardinia. We should go visit.
Absolutely.
You know,
like, yeah.
One day.
Thanks for listening to Retro Rockets. I'm your host, Andrea Johnson. Today we're talking with Rachel Cordasco. So you said something that really fascinated me a couple of minutes ago. You said you're translating something and you're looking for a publisher.
Yes.
How does that work in the United States? How does translated fiction get published? How do you, as the translator, are you responsible for selling it? How does that work?
Yeah, it really, that's a really great question. It really depends on where you are in the publishing industry. So you have one track where if you go into translation studies, you've already got a network. Like I'm not a professional translator. I never officially studied it. But if you are a professional translator, you have, studied it, you have networked with people, you are a member of the American Literary Translators Association, and you've got, I'm sure that there are like listservs and email like chains and like all kinds of groups where you can find like, okay, this person, this book is kind of circulating and it's looking for a translator, let's say you read in Spanish all the time and you've got this book and you're like, okay, I want this, I'm going to translate this, I'm going to sell it to this publisher that I know is probably going to like it. That's like one whole thing. And then there's people like me and people who aren't necessarily professional literary translators, but people who translate like technical things, and they will read in their native Russian or Korean or Hebrew, and they'll say, this is great, I love it, but they don't have that network. So what I've done is I haven't translated any like long form. I've only translated stories. And with stories, it's easier because with stories, you just submit it to the magazine, you submit it to Clark's World, Asimov's, whatever, you just, and you get, and there's that. The only reason why Creative Surgery was different was that Francesco Verso, who connected me with Clelia, he was connected to Bill Campbell from Rosarium. All I had to do was translate. So Francesco already had that connection. A lot of it is just networking, like who you know, and but if you're just sitting there like saying like this book has like the woman who translated the Diachenko's book, Vita Nostra and Daughter from the Dark, which were both really great like psychological fantasies. She is a technical translator, but she wanted her friends to be able to read these books, so she translated them into English, and then she contacted an agent, which is another thing you can do. And you can contact an agent, and the agent tries to shop it around. You can always just email, like, you can always just look at places, and, like, they'll say, we're open to unsolicited submissions, and you just send it, but the chances are much less. If you don't have an agent, if you don't know people, if you're just kind of like a random person. So the way I see it is if you know of a person that you just love their stuff and you translate like a whole bunch of stories and then you get a bunch of stories published, you can then approach a publisher and say, look, I got like 5 stories from this person published in all these like top, magazines. This would be a great collection. And then once you got your foot in the door, but again, it's just building up a lot of networking, a lot of people, a lot of it over social media.
Thank goodness for Twitter. A lot of these editors and other translators and folks involved with magazines, you and I, we've been lucky enough to learn that they're all just regular people.
Yes, just like anyone else.
Yeah, and for the most part, they're all incredibly friendly on social media and love meeting other people who love science fiction and fantasy. And if you ask them a question, it's less scary than I thought to start a conversation.
I know, that's why people are like, Twitter is such a toxic, like...
Oh, it totally is. It's an absolute dumpster fire.
Disgusting mess, and I'm like, but I've met so many nice people.
Yeah, it is an absolute, yeah.
Yeah. But it's I think that's the best way. I mean, mm-hmm. The other thing, I've been contacted by people who have said, I just saw your tweet, and I'm like, you saw my what? Like, hey, you know, maybe you should, you know, you could send mm-hmm. in an essay about this or that, you know. And I've got my feet in the translator world and the SF world, and so sometimes you'll find me writing for World Lit Today, and then sometimes you'll find me writing for Strange Horizons, and usually those people don't interact. So when I do find the people, other people who have both feet in, like, then we've got like our own little party, you know, that where I ask them to ask another person, ask another person. So, but yeah, it's hard because in publishing, they're just, you say, I got something from Italy, and people will be like, is it Elena Ferrante? And you're like, no. And it's like, oh, you know, well, how do I know it's going to be successful? You know, and you have to convince them, and they have to take a chance.
And it's probably a lot more risk on a novel than on a magazine that's publishing 8 or 10 short stories a month.
Right.
Where if they publish one, if one of the stories they publish is not that popular,
right.
Their whole industry is not going to go out of business. They're able to take different risks.
Right. Well, in like Apex,
mm-hmm.
Angry Robot, and Luna Press Publishing, which is like in Scotland. I mean, you've got like all the text publishing in Australia. You've got all these kind of, you know, smaller presses that are taking risks, but you're not, the other thing is people think it's a huge risk, but it's like Francesco Verso, for instance, you know, you publish him in English and like maybe people don't necessarily know who he is, but he's like huge in Italy. I mean, that's the same thing about Liu Cixin in China. It's like, they were like, okay, well, if like millions of people read him in China, likely they will read him in America, especially translated by Ken Liu.
And we did. We came out in droves.
Really did. So we're not, it's not like, let's publish this obscure person who no one's ever heard of in their native country. It's like the people who, I mean, for like Shimon Adolf, like I was talking about before, I mean, he's won like a billion awards in Israel. You know, so we're not publishing some random obscure person who nobody knows. Like, these are people, you know, Clelia's won multiple awards in Italy. Like, you say Clelia in Italy, everybody's like, oh, yeah, and you say her name here, and they're like, who? You know, and that's kind of like, well, it's because, you know, also Italy, the other thing is a lot of these countries, bigger countries, fund, like, cultural exchanges with the United States. So, like, France will have, like, money put toward promoting French literature in English or promoting French literature here or there. Italy doesn't really do that. And smaller countries don't do that. Like, I really don't think, like, you know, Finland. I mean, Finland actually does do some promotion, but like...
Like a smaller country, yeah, they may not have those funds available to do that kind of promotion.
Yeah, and they're not going to spend that money on that. They're going to spend it on other things, you know.
Mm-hmm.
So that's why there's just a lot going on. But without the internet... I mean, I think that SF and translation, it can exist as it does only because of the internet. I mean, how would I have ever met Clelia otherwise? Like, I've never met her in real life, you know? And yet, because I met her through someone else, I mean, I actually met Francesco in real life at ReaderCon a few years ago. But, you know, you can't meet these people or promote stuff without the internet. So it literally is like a child of the internet. And I feel like now it's getting big enough that it was born of the internet, but now it doesn't need to rely on it. You know, now you can go and, like, I've gone into Barnes & Noble, I've seen like 10 more books of SF in translation than I had seen even 5 years ago.
I just picked up an anthology of Chinese science fiction at the local bookstore here.
Right, right.
And it was on display along with all of the other new books that they had gotten in.
And that never would have happened even like 20 years ago.
No.
People weren't publishing it. People weren't, you know, stocking it, because why would you stock a book if you don't think it's going to sell? But now people are like, well, so
So it's become a lot less risky. It's become a lot more intriguing.
Right.
And thanks to the internet, we can talk more about it.
And I've been doing my part too. I hate being like nagging and shaming, but I do my part to like nag and shame people to like, oh, you only read books from like these three kind of. What about those kind
of? Oh, your nagging on Twitter is adorable. I love it. I seek it out. It's not
I'm so mean.
You're not mean. It's not mean, and it's not nagging. They're gentle reminders.
Yeah. I'm like, this is your periodic reminder that science fiction is not just written in English, guys. You know, we were like, oh yeah, you know. So, I think there's that. Like, again, it's the I love it. I want you to try it because you'll love it too. And then we can talk about it.
And it's, you love it. And you and I, we want people to, the first step to loving something is to at least be aware that it exists. And right. So many readers, fewer every year, but so many readers don't even know that this stuff exists. So we're just widening their horizons. Speaking of stuff you love, I was kind of stalking your website because I'm an interviewer and I do that. And I found your wonderful series on what looked like a gazillion novels that you read. I'm going to mispronounce this gentleman's last name. Pierre Boulez? Bouillet?
We'll call it that.
Yep. Okay. So talk to me about him and like what possessed you to read, I don't know, 15, 20 some novels by him.
Oh my God, it was just the most fun. I saw Planet of the Apes, the one from the 60s or 70s, 60s, I think. And it was like crazy, you know. And then I remember hearing like the book was totally different. And I was like, oh, whatever. And this was before my SFT days. So I'm writing the book on SFT. You know, I started a couple years ago writing it. And I'm on the French chapter, and I was like, wait, Planet of the Apes was written by a French guy? You know, this is crazy. And I was, okay, so I'm, and then I was like, wait, Pierre, I'm just gonna call him Pierre. Pierre wrote like a ton of stuff, and then mind was blown yet again when I realized that a lot of it was translated into English. And I was like, this is insane. Like, how did I not know? And his stuff was translated from the 60s through the 80s during this like golden age of like French science fiction that was just brought over into English by DAW and a couple of Vanguard and a couple other publishers. And I started reading about what these books were about, and I was like, this is nuts. He's got a book about a nuclear powered fuel tanker that has like something about the water that cools the nuclear rods or something, like performs miracles, like medical miracles. I was like, that's crazy. Then
sign me up.
I was like, what? And then he got another book about called Mirrors of the Sun, about this new prime minister in France is like, you know, we don't want nuclear energy. We don't want fossil fuels. We're just going to use solar panels. And we're going to take this part of Provence and we're going to cover it in solar panels. What could go wrong? And the whole book is all the things. It's like a list of all the things that could go wrong. They kill off like all the animals, all the insects, like all the waters are polluted. Like everybody, you know, fishermen lose their livelihood. It's like a whole. And so basically what he's doing is he's imagining what was like the big issues in his day. A lot of like environmental issues, like of nuclear power, fossil fuels, solar power. And he imagines what would happen if something is taken to an extreme.
I love that. Like, a little bit of solar power is great, so right. A ton of solar power must be better, right? Yes.
And it, like, the... But he's so logical about the steps that takes. It's like, you put a solar panel, you know, like an acre of solar panels, and the birds start dive bombing it. And then you have to, like, kill the insects that are, like, on it. Because you have one spot, and then there goes, like, some energy. And it's just, you know, and so he's imagining, like, you know, taking things to their extreme. But I think my favorite, and he's not, I wouldn't go to him for, like, you know, genius literary, like, style. You know, like, he's not going to blow your mind with his style.
But the story sounds so damn fun.
It's the story that you go to him for. But I think my favorite was Desperate Games. Desperate Games was just the most entertaining, hilarious, because he imagines that scientists get together and they convince all the world governments to just abdicate all their power to the scientists. And they're like, yeah, great, sounds good. And so all the science, and you're like, how? All the scientists, they get together and they form a world government and they literally solve all the problems.
Because scientists are good.
There's no more hunger, there's no more poverty, there's no more, like, everything is great. And then you're like, great, book is over. But it's not, because now everybody's bored. And they and there's, like, this suicide wave where it gets so bad that, like, the human race is about to go extinct because they're all killing themselves because they're so bored, because there's nothing
to do. Yeah, yeah.
There's literally nothing to strive for, and all the things the scientists imagine would happen don't happen. And so one woman's like, I got it, you know, reality games, like, let's bring back the gladiators. That'll get them going. And they say, yeah, good idea. And next thing you know, they're putting on these, like, gladiatorial games where people are literally killing each other. And then they're like, this isn't big enough. Let's reenact the like, the landing at Normandy. And then, and then they get people with, like, these planes and these boats, and they reenact stuff. And then they get it so bad that they start nuking themselves. It just everything spins out of control. And you're reading this going, like, how did he even come?
It started out just so lovely and so gentle. And then we kind of came into, like, this almost like Ian M. Banks post-scarcity society. And then everything just went off the deep end.
All went downhill. And I think his ultimate goal is to say, anytime you say we do X and Y will happen and we will all be happy, everyone should run the other way, because it's never going to be like that. It's got to be more thoughtful, more careful, and we're never going to solve all the problems.
There's no magic bullet.
Magic bullets. And he, like, nobody reads them anymore.
Well, I am now. I mean, how can I not after listening to everything you just said?
So exciting. I did get one of my friends to read him, and he was reading Mirrors of the Sun. He was like, oh my God, this is like... And I said, you're not going to read something like this now, because it, kind of like social commentary, like, meets dystopia. It's just different now.
Yeah, it's we tell those stories very differently now.
Yeah. And I think there's actually weirdly, like, more optimism now that kind of blocks some of the ability to see the downsides, you know, because you read stuff about, I mean, I've read some great stuff about people, like, you know, putting, like, solar, you know, like, things that can capture sun's energy into their bodies. And they can become, like, you know,
like
solar,
a plant.
Right? Yeah, solar powered people, and it's like, it's not a dystopia. It's like an actual thing, and you're like, that sounds cool. But you always need the Pierre Boulez, whatever. You always need the Pierres to say, okay, but that'll probably cause, like, infections if you put that in your body. You know, you need the Debbie Downers to kind of, like.
I'm laughing that you're describing that as a Debbie Downer, Because I'm thinking myself, like, if I was to embed solar stuff into my skin, and then, you know, obviously I have to go out into the sun to get energy, I would have all the energy, but I would be sunburned and I would look like a lobster.
There's just an upside and a downside.
Yeah.
You need people to show the potential downsides. But I think that a lot of things I've read lately, people say, well, there's so many downsides now. There's so much stuff that makes people depressed that people actually don't want to seek out too much. And so even the dystopias are not really dystopian. Like, even the dystopias are hopeful because, like, all the bad stuff already happened. So now we can, like, you know. But I have to caveat all of this by saying I actually only really read SF in translation. I really don't know much at all about, like, the current, like, best-selling or award-winning English language SF. Like, I have to say, I should know so that I can have something to compare it to, but I just don't have the
no
time
judgment. No, I've been myself reading a lot of stuff from 10, 15 years ago as, like, comfort rereads.
Yes.
So, yeah. Like, I'm reading an old Kat Valenti right now. I've been reading a lot of stuff from, like, 10 years ago. And
yeah.
I'm not up to date either.
Oh, yeah. I just feel like, yeah, like, people are like, oh, yeah, well, that, because I'm always about to say there's nothing like this particular book.
Oh, but there could be.
Say that because I don't know.
Yeah, I'll take this opportunity to plug some friends of mine. If you want to know what's new and exciting, head over to Nerds of a Feather.
Yes,
they're always reviewing brand new stuff, talking about newer things, interviewing authors that have new stuff coming out. So they're my go-to place. You know, even more so than like Tor.com.
Yeah.
Nerds of a Feather is like, okay, what's exciting that just came out or is coming out, and that's my go-to place. So
I need to stay up on that because
it's hard to stay up on it though. It's, you know, I can, you know, curl up on the sofa reading some book from 15 years ago, or I can watch HBO, or I can, like, oh, I can see what's new. And actually I'll just go over to the bookstore and see what's on their new shelf. Well, all right. Thank you. Thank you so much for this amazing conversation.
Sorry for all the rambling. I rambled.
No, I loved every minute of it. And my new to-be-read list is like 600 books long. And I can't wait for our listeners to just blow up their bookstore orders and Amazon orders and requests at the library. We'll know when this podcast publishes.
Yeah.
Because you'll start getting angry emails from libraries all over the country.
What are you doing?
Who is this author? Why is everybody requesting this book?
Yeah.
I want to give you just another opportunity. What's your website? Where can we find you on social media? What's the title of your book that recently came out?
So you can find me on Twitter. I used to be on Facebook and I just was like, I'm done. So I'm not on Facebook anymore, but I used to be. But now I'm just Twitter at rcordas, R-C-O-R-D-A-S. I mostly tweet about SF in translation. There's the occasional, oh my God, my kids are driving me crazy. Or, like, I also crochet. I do a lot of, like, amigurumi. So if you like amigurumi, I'll also do that. But it's mostly SF in translation. My website is sfintranslation.com. You can email me at rachel@sfintranslation.com. Super easy. The book is Out of This World, SF in Translation from the Cold War to the New Millennium. And it's out from University of Illinois. And I'm really very reachable, especially like on Twitter and email. I won't keep you, like, I won't respond to you like 6 months later. You know, I'm very
guilty of that. Like, I respond to things a month later.
Yeah, everyone's busy. It's just that, like, I'm so tired of, like, kind of, you know, like the emails where it's like just boring stuff. And then I see something like, I have a question about SF in translation. And I'm like, yes, okay, I'm here for it. I'll answer you.
Oh, so we're just fishing through our inboxes looking for the interesting emails, is what I'm hearing.
tell anyone I said it, but a secret, you know. But yeah, so I'm, you know, and at this point I'm freelance writing, and I actually have more time to do all this stuff than when I had a part-time job. So, but then there are weeks like this week when the kids are home and I can't get anything done. So things are, you know, it's kind of here and there. I may not be on Twitter as much some days and as much as I am other days, but, I just love this stuff so much, and that's why I do it. So
it sounds to me like you have a dream job, as far as I'm concerned.
It does. It pays little, but it is a dream job. So I'd like to give a big shout out to my husband, who makes the actual money so that we can survive.
I need your kids to be old enough, maybe like middle school, where their school has a career day. Because you need to go in and you know, I translate and I promote translated science fiction.
And everyone will be like, you're the what?
Oh, you will, like, they will love you. They will eat it up. Well, Rachel, thank you again so much for being my guest today.
Thank you so much for having me. It was a pleasure talking to you.
The Retro Rockets podcast explores the deep heritage of vintage and classic science fiction and fantasy. I'm your host, Andrea Johnson. Our show is recorded, mixed, and produced by Andy Robbins. John Wenger is our special consultant. Our music is by Meter through a Creative Commons license, and Carolyn Baker designed our logo. Thanks for listening, and join us again next time on Retro Rockets.